From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The words devil and brotherhood are banned from many textbooks, and the subjects of alcoholism, poverty, and divorce are off limits. On today's Fresh Air, the language police, how pressure groups restrict what students learn. We talk with Diane Ravitch, a historian of education. Her new book is about how school boards and bias and sensitivity committees have changed the language and content of textbooks, as well as standardized tests. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the stylistic differences between writers on the left and the right. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the reissue Ask Me Now, featuring clarinetist Pee Wee Russell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police in Israel say an explosion has killed at least two people and wounded dozens in a seaside area of Tel Aviv. Israel Radio said a bomb apparently went off in a cafe near the U.S. Embassy. The blast came shortly after the Palestinian parliament approved a new cabinet as part of an effort to revive the peace process with Israel. NPR's Peter Kenyon says the new prime minister, Mahmoud Abbas, pledged to curb violence against Israel and restrain Palestinian militants.
He said the unauthorized possession of weapons is a major concern that will be relentlessly addressed. It remains to be seen if that means he's prepared to forcibly take arms away from factions such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad. I spoke with one member of the legislature from Gaza who said that could be a real problem.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Jerusalem. Hospital officials in the Iraqi city of Fallujah say 13 people died after U.S. forces fired on a crowd of demonstrators. A U.S. Army spokesman at the scene said soldiers returned fire after coming under armed attack by the crowd. NPR's Guy Raz reports from Fallujah.
U.S. soldiers say men in the crowd fired AK-47 assault rifles at their position. The incident happened after a crowd of demonstrators massed in front of a school which the U.S. Army is using as a temporary base. A company from the 82nd Airborne Division took over the school 2 weeks ago. Residents in the city say they were calling on the soldiers to vacate the school and withdraw from the city. The demonstrators say they were unarmed, but U.S. Army officers showed reporters at the scene bullet holes inside the school that they say were fired from the crowd. It's the third time in 2 weeks U.S. soldiers in Iraq exchanged gunfire with demonstrators. The other two incidents took place in the northern city of Mosul. Guy Raz, NPR News, Fallujah.
The World Health Organization is lifting its warning against travel to Toronto, NPR's Richard Knox reports.
Only 5 days ago, the WHO warned travelers to avoid Toronto because of severe acute respiratory syndrome. Canadian health officials protested that the WHO's information was out of date. In an hour-long meeting this morning in Geneva, Ontario Health Minister Tony Clement told WHO officials that the danger to Toronto visitors is past.
The last case of a non-health care worker getting the disease was back on April 9th, which is 20 days ago now. And the last case of a health care worker was back on April 20th.
Once 20 days have passed with no more SARS cases, experts consider the chain of transmission to be broken. Canadian officials promise they will soon start screening at airports to prevent the import or export of any more SARS cases. Richard Knox, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 31 points to close at 8,502 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 9 points. It closed at 1,471. This is NPR News. A close friend and lawyer of Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been found guilty of bribing judges. The verdict could have political repercussions. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
The verdict was handed down by the three presiding judges after 8 hours in chambers, and its announcement at late evening was met with a loud applause by the crowded courtroom in Milan. Cesare Previti, a defense minister in the previous Berlusconi government and now a member of parliament for the Prime Minister's Forza Italia party, was sentenced to 11 years in jail and banned from practicing law for 5 years. Previti was charged with bribing judges to favor the takeover of a large publishing company by Berlusconi's Fininvest firm. Charges were originally brought also against the prime minister, but dropped because of the statute of limitations. The verdict could turn up the heat on Berlusconi, who faces similar charges in a separate trial. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
President Bush appealed to Congress today to approve his 5-year plan to spend $15 billion on the global fight against AIDS. He said his program would prevent 7 million new HIV infections and treat millions of people in the next decade. The president has said he wants the program to focus on prevention education rooted in what he called the proven abstinence-based approach. That has stirred some opposition in Congress from lawmakers who say the program should be adaptable to local customs in other countries. The House is considering a bill sponsored by Representative Henry Hyde, which is close to the president's request. It could go to the full House for a vote as early as Thursday. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 3 points to close at 917. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy. On the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You're unlikely to see the words senile or Satan in a textbook. They are among dozens of words that are virtually banned by the school boards and bias and sensitivity committees, which advise the publishers of standardized tests and textbooks. These groups also exert control over the subject matter of textbooks. My guest Diane Ravitch says some of the censorship is trivial, some is ludicrous, and some is breathtaking in its power to dumb down what children learn in school. Ravitch is the author of the new book, The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. She's a historian of education who teaches at New York University, and she's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ravitch was assistant secretary in charge of research in the U.S. Department of Education in the administration of George H.W. Bush. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Clinton. I asked Diane Ravitch, who are the language police?
The language police is no longer people with names and faces. It really is just a process or a system that's been created to censor textbooks and tests. It's now a system that involves sanitizing words, topics from standardized tests, and also from which are used across the country, both national tests and state tests. And it's the self-censorship that publishers have imposed. And it really doesn't have to do with specific people anymore. It's about accepting as the industry standard that whatever is put before American school children, either in their textbooks or tests, has to be cleansed of certain words and language and topics.
Let's go over some of the words that are considered unacceptable and that need to be replaced, and some of the words that are totally banned. Okay, the word devil is in some places banned altogether. Why?
Right, because this banning process of putting together words and topics that are banned comes from both people from the right and people from the left. And the whole process is a response to left-wing and right-wing censorship. Anything to do with the devil or fantasy or Satan or witchcraft or witches is offensive to very conservative groups. And so very conservative groups have imposed a ban on words like the devil or anything to do with witchcraft. That explains, for example, why the Harry Potter series today is not only the most popular series. It doesn't explain why it's the most popular series. It's the most banned books in the country because of the references to witchcraft, and also because Harry Potter has a dysfunctional family. And both of those are topics that the right wing hates.
So if the word devil is banned, does that mean that you also can't read books by, say, Nathaniel Hawthorne in high schools now?
Well, you know, the fact is a lot of teachers assign novels that are complete, and they assign novels that contain words that are on this list. Where this list has the most impact is on textbook publishing. And you may occasionally find a word that's on that list that appears in a textbook, but on the whole, you know, for the most part, textbook publishers are watching for these words and watching for these topics and very, very carefully exclude them, because they know that if they go to a state like California or Texas with one of these words or topics included, they run the risk of first of all, setting off a huge controversy because groups will come and complain about them, and not having their textbook adopted at all, which would be a huge economic loss. So the better part of wisdom for textbook publishers and test publishers is to drop controversial words.
Now, the word extremist in some places can't be used because It has to be replaced with believer, follower, or adherent. Now, believer, follower, and adherent have a different meaning than extremist. Why can't you use the word extremist?
Well, amongst the different categories of words that are banned are words that are comparative in nature. So, for example, the word heretic is a banned word because that's an ethnocentric judgment. You know, one man's heretic is another man's adherent. Also, the word dogma is a banned word for the same reason, and the word cult is banned. So all of these are useful, valuable words, but they are considered ethnocentric. So and also words like culturally disadvantaged or economically disadvantaged are banned, and the word the expression backward or backward country as a relative term is banned. So all of these comparative judgments are considered ethnocentric, and those are all out.
Okay, let's look at some of the stereotyped images that need to be avoided in textbooks. There's a group of images of women that one should avoid. Women portrayed as mothers, teachers, nurses, or secretaries. What's the problem with that?
Well, these have all been considered stereotype roles for women, and so they're out. And feminist groups complained very mightily and loudly in the 1980s and 1990s, and that's why there is a long list of female images or things that are considered female occupations in the past that are not permitted anymore. So women are supposed to be portrayed as, you know, truck drivers and soldiers and doctors and leaders, but not as wives or nurses or secretaries or teachers.
So are there really a lot of textbooks where a woman can't be a mother in a story?
You know, there may be here and there a story with a woman portrayed as a mother, but that would not be her primary role. Mainly what you would see is complete gender equality, and where men and women, girls and boys, are all doing exactly the same thing.
Okay, African-American images to avoid include African-Americans in crowded tenements or chaotic streets, in big, bright cars, in abandoned buildings with broken windows, or living in innocuous, dull, white picket fence neighborhoods. Your comment?
Well, it's very hard to know how someone who's illustrating a textbook can fairly and honestly portray any ethnic group unless they just show them as being without any characteristics. I mean, as you look through the different kinds of images to avoid the so-called stereotypes, it's anything that would be culturally specific that would make one appear to be African-American or Asian-American or Hispanic-American, anything that would be actually highlight differences. So the odd thing about this is that so many of these bans are intended to promote diversity when, in fact, they promote homogeneity because everyone ends up looking the same but with a slightly different skin hue.
So for Asian-Americans, it's considered a stereotype if you represent an Asian-American as very intelligent, an excellent scholar, ambitious, hardworking, or competitive.
This is considered a stereotype. It's called the model minority myth, and this is offensive to someone, so that's one of the ways that you're not supposed to portray Asian Americans.
Okay, older Americans, images to avoid include older Americans in nursing homes or with canes, walkers, wheelchairs, orthopedic shoes, or eyeglasses. Is it not a fact of life that at some point, and people are living into their 80s and 90s now, that at some point you need help walking, or you certainly need eyeglasses?
Well, I think that the stereotyped images of older Americans is one that I find the most amusing because I am now, I think, an older American. I'm 64, and there are days when I feel weak and dependent and sickly, but I can't be portrayed looking that way. So I think this whole thing is very amusing because I believe the intention is that you're only supposed to portray men and women, let's say in their 70s or 80s, snowboarding and climbing up on the roof to repair the roof or jogging or running a marathon. It's really ridiculous because what these kinds of images suggest, what the avoidance of these images suggest, is that you can't describe reality.
Now, how many states would you say have to follow the majority of the guidelines that you've just discussed in terms of language and stereotypical images? Are we talking about 3-4 states? Are we talking about 40 states?
My description of censorship in the testing industry and the textbook industry does not affect 3 or 4 states. It describes what's happening in every part of the United States because it affects the four mega corporations that dominate educational publishing. It also affects every major testing company. Every major testing company uses what's called bias and sensitivity review to make sure there are no offensive or insensitive words or topics. And the process that I've described as language policing is omnipresent throughout educational publishing, throughout the textbook industry, and throughout the testing industry. There is no state that escapes this. There may be individual classrooms that escape it because their teachers are using, let's say, real novels that have not been sanitized or Baudelaireized. And they may be making up their own tests, which would consist of, let's say, essays about what they've read. But if they're using standardized tests and if they're using mass-produced textbooks, then what the students encounter has been sanitized and, to some extent, Baudelaireized by the language police.
My guest is Diane Ravitch, author of the new book, The Language Police. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Ravitch. She's a historian of education. Her new book is called The Language Police: How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. You first came across bias and sensitivity review panels when you were working on a standardized test. You had worked to come up with readings and to approve them, and then you found out what?
Well, I was appointed to something called the National Assessment Governing Board. It's a federal agency that administers national tests. And I was appointed during the Clinton administration by President Clinton. And President Clinton had decided in 1997 that he thought there should be a voluntary national test that included a fourth grade reading test. And so the first thing that I did as a member of that organization and a federal organization was to read fourth grade passages that might appear on this voluntary national test. And as a member of a fairly sizable committee of people reading passages, we approved, dozens of passages that would be appropriate for fourth grade children. And about 18 months later, about 15 or 20 of these passages were returned to us, and we were told that they were biased or insensitive and should be deleted. And I was shocked because some of them were all of them were completely innocuous passages, and I didn't see any bias in them. And just to give you some examples, one of them was a short biography of the man who designed Mount Rushmore, Gutzon Borglum. And it seemed appropriate for fourth graders. Almost everyone is familiar with that image of the four massive presidential heads. But the bias reviewers said that we could not have that question because Mount Rushmore was built on the land that was sacred to the Lakota Indians, and therefore this whole passage should be deleted, and they recommended that it be eliminated. Another passage was about a woman named Mary McLeod Bethune, who was an African-American woman, a leader. She created a school for girls in Daytona, Florida in the early 20th century, and we thought it was a great passage, a wonderful hero story. And they said it should be deleted, first of all, because the school was called the Daytona Industrial and Training School for Negro Girls, and they said that the word Negro should not appear in a standardized test, even though that actually was the name of her school. And secondly, because her son Albert attended, and they said if that was mentioned, then kids would know that she was separated from her husband, and we could not have separation as a topic. Are acknowledging that people, women and men, separated in their marriages. A third passage that I thought was an excellent passage was a true story about a 25-year-old man who was blind, who was the first blind man to climb Mount McKinley, and he did this in an ice storm, and it was an inspiring story. And they said this should be eliminated, first of all, because the story contained regional bias. It happened in an ice storm, and kids who had never seen an ice storm wouldn't be able to understand the story. So that was regional bias. And then they said it should be eliminated because it was biased against blind people. And since it was a heroic story, I couldn't understand why that was biased. But then they said, well, it's biased against blind people because it suggests that it's heroic for him to have climbed Mount McKinley as a blind person, and blindness should not be treated as a handicap. Well, I thought all of this was bizarre. And then I went back and realized that the test publisher, had actually given us a set of guidelines, and I had looked at them thinking how odd they were. And I went back and reviewed them and discovered that we had about 25 or 30 pages describing all of these topics, regional bias and, that you couldn't treat blindness as a handicap. All of that was laid out. And I became fascinated with the idea of where this notion of bias came from, that so many commonplace ideas should suddenly be construed as bias. And I began gathering bias guidelines from many different publishers of textbooks and tests, and that was the genesis of this book.
One of the textbook publishers that you got guidelines from is called Riverside Publishing. What do they publish?
Riverside was the test publisher for the voluntary national test. They also published the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, and they were the first to show me these guidelines. Now, I don't think they're publicly available. We only got a copy of them because we were members of a federal agency overseeing the development of the voluntary national test. But this is a very important mainstream test publisher. And what I've learned since I've contacted many other test publishers is that the Riverside guidelines are very similar to the guidelines of ETS, National Evaluation System, American Institutes of Research, and virtually all the state testing agencies. And that's how I came to understand that the scrutinizing of tests for anything that might offend anybody anywhere is considered the industry standard.
Now, the guidelines of Riverside Publishing say that you cannot refer to evolution, but you also can't refer to fossils or dinosaurs because they suggest evolution?
Well, that's correct. You can't refer to anything that might imply evolution. You also can't refer to Halloween because Halloween suggests witchcraft, and witchcraft is another one of those banned topics because it offends right-wing parents.
But you also can't discuss social problems like poverty, alcoholism, and divorce.
Correct. Those are out because they upset somebody. I'm not sure whether it's the right wing or the left wing, but however you raise those problems, it's going to be offensive to someone.
Slavery and racial prejudice are taboo?
Right. Those are offensive to, again, you can't always say who it will offend, but they know from past experience that they will get letters from one or more people saying, I don't like that question, I don't like that topic. And so the simplest thing to avoid controversy is just to delete it.
Catastrophes like earthquakes and fires are to be avoided. That's not a politically correct issue, is it?
That's considered a topic. Earthquakes, fires, or let's say references to creepy animals or to rats and mice, those would be upsetting to sensitive children. And the claim is that if children encounter something on a test that upsets them, they won't be able to do their best. And so you must take care to avoid, let's say cancer, someone losing their job, unemployment. All of these are earthquakes, fires. This is all very upsetting to someone somewhere, so therefore it should not be mentioned.
Now, you say that the method in which textbooks are purchased has a lot to do with the kind of patrolling of language that we're seeing now. What is the system of purchasing textbooks that has influenced the content of textbooks?
Today there are 22 states in which the State Board of Education selects the textbooks that are to be used throughout the state. Now, some teachers can buy other books, but their district has to put the money up. The state won't pay for it. So it becomes a very powerful tool with which the State Board of Education can make these purchases and influence what's taught in the schools. The problem comes about because there are two states in particular, California and Texas, have a huge amount of power. They have such large enrollments. And if a publisher can't get their textbook sold in these two states, the chances are they're not going to make it as a publisher. They may even go out of business, or they won't even attempt to get a national adoption at all. So these two states wield huge power, and because they're like a choke for the textbook process, pressure groups can come before the Texas State Board of Education and the California State Board of Education and wield enormous power way out of any relationship to their size. So what's happened is that this narrowing of the marketplace to conform to the needs of Texas and California has, first of all, caused tremendous concentration in the publishing industry. There are today only four big corporations that publish textbooks. They're not the only ones, but they dominate about 75 to 80% of the textbook market. The only one of these that is American-owned at the moment is McGraw-Hill. The others are Reed Elsevier, which is Dutch, Pearson, which is British, and Vivendi, which is French. And Vivendi has been in the process of selling off Houghton Mifflin, so it will hopefully soon be, again, an American-owned textbook company. But there are basically right now only four big companies publishing for the most of the market. Because of the way state textbook adoption has narrowed competition, it's made it so expensive to get into the business at all. So what has happened over the past 15 or 20 years is that the publishers have accepted the responsibility for self-censorship. The groups that I've described in my book no longer need to go before the State Board of Education and harass them about textbooks because they have successfully gotten the publishers to self-censor.
So when Texas and California were more active with their own bias and sensitivity reviews, were their concerns similar or were their concerns different?
Well, California was considered the liberal state and Texas the conservative state. And so the California social content guidelines, which are still in effect, required publishers to have a very careful gender balance. But then so did Texas require gender balance. And NOW went before the state boards in both states to demand gender balance to the extent where Open Court, which is one of the books that where I was able to get the internal correspondence because it changed hands. And so the publisher who no longer owns the company gave me the internal correspondence. Open Court had, in its book, had to change the little engine that could into a female engine as a way of increasing the representation of females. There were other books where the textbook publisher had to literally change the gender of a character. And in one case that I found, the author went along with the idea of changing Freddie to Maggie in order to increase the representation of women.
Diane Ravitch is the author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Children Learn. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of Life of Pi by Yann Martell, a modern-day adventure story, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the stylistic differences between writers on the left and the right. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new reissue featuring clarinetist Pee Wee Russell. And we continue our discussion with Diane Ravitch, author of The Language Police. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Diane Ravitch, author of the new book, The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. It's about the school boards and bias and sensitivity committees, which have virtually banned certain words and subjects from textbooks and standardized tests. Ravitch says now textbook publishers practice self-censorship. Ravitch is a historian of education. She teaches at NYU and is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. You try to trace the beginnings of this move toward politically correct, sanitized language in textbooks and standardized tests. And you date it to the late 60s, early 70s, and the civil rights movement of that period. What were the original intentions and what were the original issues?
Well, the original issues were valid. There was a complete absence of stories about American blacks. There was a tremendous imbalance in terms of how girls were portrayed. Girls were always the helper. They were never the active participant in anything. And girls were, well, it was the kind of Dick and Sally routine where Dick in the Dick and Jane textbooks was always the one who was actively doing things, and Sally or Jane were holding his coat for him or urging him on. So I think there was quite a valid concern about the role of women was changing, and the representation of girls should reflect that.
Where do you feel that movement that you think of as being very justified went off track?
I would say that the movement went off track when it veered into censorship. I found that, for instance, with an organization that was quite instrumental and the events in the Language Police, the Council on Interracial Books for Children. It began as an advocacy group that said there should be more and better stories about the life of minorities, of blacks and of Hispanics, and also of women in textbooks. And it went from advocating adding to what children read and improving the quality of what they read to issuing censorship list, issuing list saying, we don't like what's in this book, it shouldn't be read. These stories should be stigmatized. They even suggested to the American Library Association that certain books, which did not have the correct representation or portrayal of these groups, should be removed from the library shelves or should be labeled in such a way that would stigmatize them. That became a censorship campaign. And, you know, quite frankly, the National Organization for Women did some of the same thing. When you urge people not to read books, when you stigmatize books because you don't like the portrayals in them, then that's censorship. But it goes beyond trying to say, here's something I think is better, I hope you'll read it, to don't read Mary Poppins. The Council for Interracial Books for Children actually urged that fairy tales be eliminated. And there was a long list of classic works, including Mary Poppins and the Roald Dahl books, that they considered to be inappropriate. And, of course, a series of books that was banned at the urging of the Council for Interracial Books for Children was the Hugh Lofting Dr. Doolittle books. And I tried to find the original copies, the original language of the Dr. Doolittle books, and it's virtually impossible. I couldn't find it in the library. I couldn't find it on the internet. And only the rewritten version is available. Then I discovered the New York Public Library has them in a special collection, apparently because it has portrayals of Africans that are unacceptable.
Now, you reviewed a dozen world history textbooks while writing your new book. What are some of the things that you found could not be discussed or could not be discussed in a clear way?
Well, what I got for the most part from reading the world history books was first of all, a huge sense of boredom. It's just an unbelievable mass of material that has no thematic connection. What's missing, and I think in part because of these bias guidelines, is any effort to compare cultures or civilizations. You're not allowed to say that one is more or less advanced than another. That's out. And so when there's a discussion of the Mayans and the Aztecs, they're presented as a glorious civilization, which I'm sure that they were, but without the downside, which is that they practiced human sacrifice and that it was a pretty terrible time to be alive. Also, only one of the books that I reviewed mentions the fact that that they had not yet discovered the wheel, which was kind of an important technological discovery. But there's an effort on the part of the publishers and the authors to present every civilization as glorious. And so because this represents a kind of sanitizing of history and a kind of prettifying of it that takes away from reality, which is that a civilization can be quite glorious in its art and even in its architecture and be quite brutal at the same time. And you're not telling the whole story if you only tell the pretty parts.
You say that it's very difficult to discuss religion now in history texts. What are the problems?
Well, all religions have to be presented in a positive light. And I looked at this in terms of how is Islam presented? And, you know, Islam is a great religion. There's no question that the Islamic civilization in the Middle Ages was the greatest civilization at that time. But when the textbooks deal with modern-day Islam, they become tongue-tied. They have a hard time discussing the role of women in Islam, for example. And they talk only about how women's rights have expanded under Islam. One of the textbooks has a photograph of a group of women, head-to-toe burqas, going on a boating expedition. And, you know, this is, I think it's a problem that American kids have to talk about, with quite honestly, about the question of the role of women in Islam. The reason the textbooks have such a hard time discussing Islam, or any other religion for that matter, is that all of them, almost all of them, there's one exception, has a multicultural advisory board. Three of the major publishers have exactly the same advisor on the Islamic religion, and so they all echo each other with a very positive picture of the role of women in Islam, and not mentioning, for example, what we would consider somewhat brutal treatment of minor crimes, like having your hands cut off or being beheaded. And you know, maybe this is or is not brutal, but at least it should be discussed. It isn't even discussed because everything has been reviewed by the same Islamic advocacy group, a small group out in California. And three of the four publishers submit their materials for this person's approval.
My guest is Diane Ravitch, author of the new book, The Language Police. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Ravitch. She's a historian of education. Her new book is called The Language Police: How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. After, you know, after researching this long critique of American textbooks, what are your conclusions about what the larger problem is? You know, if the textbooks have been vetted and in many cases censored, what's the larger educational problem this is creating?
I think it's important for children in school, young people in school, to read exciting narratives, and they're not going to find that in a textbook. Now, a textbook may be a perfectly useful reference work, and I did find a few that I liked. In world history, there was one called World History, Continuity and Change. And the U.S. histories, there some were better than others, and I described those. But the overall problem with textbooks is that there's a narrative that says we know the answers to these questions. They've all been settled, and here's fact. And that's deadly. That's deadly. What kids need to learn in school is, no, we don't know the answers. We're still struggling to figure things out. Historians are arguing that at the time things happened, nobody knew how things would turn out. I mean, when you watch something on TV and it's a terrific documentary and get a sense of the times, it's so exciting. And the textbook kills that. The textbook kills the sense of not knowing the answer and how uncertain people were at the time of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, these guys put their life on the line. They could have all been strung up and killed by the British for signing that document. But it's never presented as contingent, as controversial, but as a settled fact. And I think there's an overall problem of boredom that results from all of these settled facts being strung together.
Now, I went to public schools in the 1960s before the language police era, and I can tell you that the textbooks that I read were dull, and they weren't controversial. They didn't examine issues or the past in an interesting way. So, I mean, has anything fundamentally changed?
I think that some things...
In other words, have the textbooks ever been good? Have they ever been interesting?
I think that you'd have to go probably go back to the earlier part of the 20th century to find textbooks that were engaging. And the reason they were engaging was that they were written by one person. And when you have one person writing the book and taking responsibility for the words in it, then there is a, there's a better chance you're going to have a voice. I mean, the biggest problem with textbooks, and it would have been true of the textbooks of the, whether it was the 60s or the 50s or now, is the lack of voice. And the lack of voice creates this kind of omniscient, you are reading an encyclopedia, you are reading fact, and you are being bored out of your skull. That's a problem. And so I think about textbooks I've written that were, or textbooks that I've read that were written many years ago. And I think about David Saville Muzzy's textbooks, which were lively and engaging. And there were others, you know, Charles Beard wrote textbooks. There were other wonderful historians, but they took responsibility for their language, and they weren't going to put out something that had been generated by committee. And today the textbooks, some of them have authors' names on them where the authors are dead. And, you know, who knows who writes them? They go through a process of almost like a meat grinder, and what comes out is this kind of plodding prose.
What do you think it would take to change the course of history and literature textbooks and to undo the work of what you describe as the literary police, the language police?
To remove the language police from our schools would mean removing them both from textbook publishing and from testing. And I think the first thing that has to happen is to end state textbook adoptions. I think this is the beginning of the corruption of this whole process of buying books for schools, is giving the states the power to say, to anoint one textbook and to reject everything else. I think that the decisions about what books to be used in the classroom should primarily be made by individual teachers. And this would right away encourage a real marketplace instead of having a massive concentration of textbook publishers. There would be the possibility of small publishers selling to classrooms and to teachers because their product is better. So that would have, I think, a beneficent impact. It would take time because this current system is so deeply ingrained that it would take time to, in effect, revive a marketplace for real publishers to sell things to the classroom. Secondly, I think in terms of test publishing, there should be much more openness and transparency than there is today. Today, there is virtually no transparency. I wrote to one state education department. I wrote to many state education departments and asked them for examples of works or passages that had been censored for their state test, and got some responses. But in one case, a state education department wrote me and said, we don't have to tell that to you. Now, this is a public agency, and they're censoring literary materials, and their view is they don't have to explain that to anyone. I believe they should, as a matter of law, be required to put on a website what kinds of materials they're using for their state test. We would find out whether they're using good literature or junk, and they should also show what they've excerpted, what have they sanitized, what have they censored, what have they bowdlerized. So that would be a huge step forward, is just to open up the censorship of the testing process. Also put on their website what their bias guidelines are. People like me wouldn't have to dig so hard to find out what's actually being censored. It's going on everywhere, and we just don't even know what it is. So that, to me, is the great scandal, is that most of this censorship is taking place behind closed doors. It's considered a good thing to do, and it has to be brought out into the open.
Well, Diane Ravitch, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Diane Ravitch is the author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Children Learn. She's a professor of education at NYU. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been reading political newspaper columnists from the left and the right. He's observed that their differences are not just in what they say, but how they say it.
The stylistic differences between the left and right aren't just a question of the words they use, but the tunes they sing them to. Listen to a recent piece by the Wall Street Journal's Peggy Noonan on the resurgence of patriotism, or as she calls it, the simple idea of the goodness of loving America. The nation that won the war, she said, wasn't made up of the big city elites. It was a bigger America and a realer one, a healthy and vibrant place full of religious feeling and cultural energy and Bible study and garage bands and sports love and mom love and sophistication and normality. And that repetition of conjunctions is the device that rhetoricians call polysyndeton. It does a lot of work for Noonan here. Each of those ands implies an and not, an opposition to the urban cosmopolitans who don't have religious feeling, don't study the Bible, don't love their moms, and don't have garage bands, most likely because they don't have garages. They're the people that Noonan describes as the intellectuals, academics, and leftist mandarins, not to mention the local clever people who talk too loudly in restaurants. Now, who would they be? Then, too, the ands flatten the differences among all those unlike things, replace the conjunctions with commas, and all of a sudden the thought emerges in all its vacuous incoherence. A place full of religious feeling, cultural energy, Bible study, garage band, sports love, mom love, sophistication, and normality. You hear that rhythm a lot in Noonan's prose. It was daring and brilliant and brave. You want to really feel it and experience it and smell it and touch it and thank God for it. But then a lot of columnists use this device, particularly the ones on the right. Take Michelle Malkin's letter to American soldiers. You hail from Middletown and Middleborough and Greenville and Reading and Thousand Oaks and Mapletree. She forgets to mention the Bronx. William Bennett writes that real fatherhood means love and commitment and sacrifice and a willingness to share responsibility and not walking away from one's children. Paul Greenberg talks about country breakfast and jukeboxes and cowboy hats and denim and mamas and papas. True, you won't hear this rhythm from conservatives like William F. Buckley, George Will, Jean Kirkpatrick, or William Safire, none of them writers who were given to flights of gush. And there are certainly liberal writers with a weakness for the device, like the tirelessly expansive Molly Ivins. But even so, you're about five times as likely to encounter this pattern on conservative sites like the National Review and townhall.com as on liberal sites like The Nation or The American Prospect. Of course, it isn't as if polysyndeton has an inherently political meaning or any inherent meaning at all. It's a device that's been used by everyone from Shakespeare to Lewis Carroll to Bob Dylan. But the pattern has a particular cadence in American writing where it signals plenitude and immediacy, as if you're laying your thoughts down one scoop after another. It bubbles up whenever people are waxing sentimental about dogs, baseball, or the English language, particularly about the English language, I've noticed. And it's a staple of eulogies and, of course, book blurbs, where it's often compounded by alliteration, wise and weird and witty and warm. Ultimately, this is just another one of the things we can blame Walt Whitman for, along with all the other writers who mimicked his voluble spontaneity. But it's not likely that Peggy Noonan picked this up directly from Whitman, much less from Allen Ginsberg or Gary Snyder. If you listen to her sentences, you hear another, even more familiar voice.
Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath?
Or who can forget this speech, a favorite of people who do Jimmy Stewart impressions?
No, but you're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here. Well, your money's in Joe's house, that's right next to yours, and in the Kennedy house, and Mrs. Maitland's house, and 100 others.
It's all there in Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, not to mention Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, The Grapes of Wrath, and dozens of other movies and plays from the 30s and 40s. It's the pattern that playwrights and screenwriters used when they wanted to evoke the artless wisdom of the common man. That's what Noonan and the others are aiming for with this pattern, the rhythm of the simple feelings that are obvious to everybody but the clever people who make life too complicated. But the device is apt to sound a bit calculated and self-conscious when you run into it in the Wall Street Journal, particularly in an age as knowing as ours is. Back in Capra's time, people didn't make it a point of pride to be in touch with their feelings. Reading Noonan's column, I kept thinking of the recent remake of Capra's Mr. Deeds Goes to Town with Adam Sandler in the Gary Cooper role. At the end of her piece, Noonan says, "Is this corny? Too bad." Well, no. Capra was corny, and so were Robert Riskin and Nunnally Johnson and Joe Swirling and Sidney Buckman and Clifford Odets and Robert Sherwood. even if they lived in big cities and didn't go to Bible study classes and talked too loudly in restaurants. But what Noonan does isn't corny, it's kitsch.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the author of The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of Pee Wee Russell's recording, Ask Me Now. This is Fresh Air. Clarinetist Pee Wee Russell was born in 1906 and usually recorded in Dixieland settings, but with his oblique solo style, Russell never really fit in, an oblong peg in a square hole. In the 1950s and 60s, his champions presented him alongside progressives like Jimmy Giuffre and Thelonious Monk. Now comes a reissue of a 1963 album where Pee Wee Russell played tunes by groundbreakers like John Coltrane and Ornette Coleman. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
That modern blues is Ornette Coleman's turnaround. That solo with those sour notes, muttered asides, and throwaway line endings is vintage Pee Wee Russell. His solos could sound misshapen or haphazard, but they had their own unpremeditated grace. Pee Wee Russell's improvising is a metaphor junkie's dream. He's always stepping off a cliff, running up a blind alley, or rummaging blind in the knife drawer. Fed up with the Dixieland scene, in 1962 he began leading a quartet masterminded by valve trombonist and bass trumpeter Marshall Brown. The lack of piano in the space age repertoire aimed to highlight Russell's revamped image as a modernist before his time. The quartet's second album, Ask Me Now, is back out on Impulse. This is John Coltrane's Some Other Blues. In the long run, Russell wasn't too happy with his new quartet. Musical director Marshall Brown had been a high school teacher and leader of the Newport Youth Orchestra and treated the master like his protege. Brown wanted his free jazz jams mapped out in advance. Pee Wee grumped, "I haven't taken so many orders since military school." And Brown's four-square phrasing made for an awkward fit with the unpredictable clarinetist. Thank you. Ronnie Bedford on drums and Russell George on bass. Putting Pee Wee Russell in a modern band was a good idea, but he needed better company. In hindsight, the right players were close at hand. That same season, his trombonist friend, Roswell Rudd, was playing Monk tunes in a pianoless quartet with soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy, another modernist who came up in Dixieland bands. Lacy and Rudd's 1963 classic, School Days, has just been reissued on Headology, and it makes for an instructive comparison with Pee-wee's date. If only they'd invited him in for his sake. Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd, alas, without Pee Wee Russell. So much for what might have been. That summer, Russell sat in with Monk's Quartet at the 1963 Newport Jazz Festival. Columbia reissued those sides last year. But they hadn't rehearsed and barely interacted, and Pee Wee felt ill at ease all over again. In a way, his unsettled career was like one of his solos writ large. He could never find a good place to alight, so he kept hopping around. His perpetual discomfort sparked his creativity.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands, a novel set in 1951 Florida at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement by Susan Carol McCarthy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The FDA's job is to create regulatory standards that protect consumers, but the agency faces claims from industry that regulation hurts profits and stymies research. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Philip J. Hiltz talks about his new history of the FDA. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.